Reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Part 2, verse 30. Ahimsa satyasya samacharya parigriha yamaha. The yamas are nonviolence, truthfulness, refrainment from stealing, celibacy, and renunciation of unnecessary possessions. We shouldn't have a problem today with the class as we had the last few times. I have a person here to put on the generator in case the electricity goes to keep my phone recharged. At least I think he must be here, but the electricity is on. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnanandana Salakaya Taksurin Mulitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave. Pancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhu bhayevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramo, Hare Ramo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Greetings from Vrindavan. After the class, I'll head to Delhi, and then Mayapur and Puri. Our future class will be from there. Also take note that the next classes, there is a new phone number that Rati Krishna has sent around. So this is the practice to get to the platform of yoga, which has a very, very high adhikari eligibility in dispassion. Patanjali, who is summing up, or his sutra is codifying the knowledge existing at the time through the sacred texts of India on the nature of the mind and how to control it. Begins by explaining a threefold process of Kriya Yoga, which will subdue the mind and bring it to a point where you can actually meditate and from that platform of meditation achieve the goal of yoga, which is to stop the thoughts. Again, I know most of you are bhakti practitioners. Yoga process is quite different than the process of bhakti, which doesn't try to stop the thoughts, but tries to stop those thoughts that are unrelated to devotion. And then purifies the mind by the shakti or potency of bhakti, which is petitioned in one's prayers. So Patanjali here has threefold process, and then there was also an eightfold process, Astanga Yoga, which is a little bit more elaborate. And the three aspects of Kriya Yoga are included within that, which is tapas or austerity, swadhyaya or study of sacred texts, and Ishvara Pranidhan, or dedicating oneself to God, surrendering to God. So we're in the list of those. It's going to be a description now of those eight limbs. Yam, yam, pranayam, pratyahara, dharana, dhyan, samadhi. So systematically they're being discussed, and we left off our last discussion by discussing, the last class we discussed, this verse here on the yamins, nonviolence, truthfulness, refraining from stealing, celibacy, or renunciation of unnecessary possessions. Just to give a kind of a context of it, we did discuss that it is a progressive process, that one activity requires a accomplishment in the previous, and that the basis of all yamas, again, the difference is yamas are moral restraints and niyamas are moral observances. In other words, how you relate, how you act in relationship to others, and then how you act in relationship to yourself. And this is the basis, the foundation of controlling the mind. You have to work on nonviolence, because the core of material consciousness is competition, getting ahead. That's what drives it. So if you don't make some strategy to restrain the foundational material consciousness by nonviolence, there's no question of controlling the mind. So this was discussed first, and not injuring. I mean, it's basic. It's ABC. Not injuring another living entity at any time. And that includes purifying oneself internally of the spirit of malice and hatred, which produces this tendency. So we discussed it. It was like a very nice analogy, like an elephant's footprint accommodates all other footprints. So ahimsa, within ahimsa, are all the other yamas must fit. And then we began to discuss truth, integrity between one's words and thoughts. In other words, what one has, by the tools available to one, ascertained is truth. One must line their life up in relationship to that. And that speech that one has should not be misleading, therefore, and also it should not be devoid of value, because your conceptions or ideals should have value. So frivolous talk, which is not lined up with one's values and conceptions that one has ascertained to be true, is not good. The truth should be for the benefit of people, and certainly not for their harm. So, one should not be bluffing. So this is the idea, to speak truth carefully, and it's so important. And then there's a quote here from Manu Samhita. Let him not speak what is true but unkind. Let him speak what is kind and not untrue. that is eternal righteousness. And then there was a reference from the Mahabharata where in a very, very challenging circumstance, Yudhisthira, to save his military force from the unconquerable wrath of Dronacharya, had to employ some psychological warfare to try to depress Dronacharya by telling him that his son had died. Just anything to stop him. And you know how heavy that is. I mean, it's hard to keep up your spirit of malice and your spirit of war, whatever it is that's driving you, when you're the one most dear to you. So Yudhisthira just never told a lie in his life. But for the sake of the battle, he said Ashwatthama is dead. Ashwatthama is the son of Dronacharya. But he was so controlled that he thought of the elephant Ashwatthama that got killed. But although it was technically truthful, it was purposely deceitful and misleading. And then Yudhisthira's chariot, which never touched the ground due to his righteousness, fell to the ground. Truth must never result in violence, which again, because ahimsa is the foundation. So, you can't observe one yama, truthfulness, that results in another, the violation of another yama, ahimsa. Ahimsa must be prime and respected. So, And therefore, the truth also should not speak it unkindly. You know, you can say a lot of things that are true that will cause mental violence to people also.
Just being frank, Prabhu.
Now this is to yogis. Yogis are ascetics, and any spiritual practitioner has elements of that within them, some tasya, but this is really, if you're dealing directly with the mind, here it says, avoid untruth extends to the point of abstaining from being fiction. The yogi is always contemplating spiritual truth and does not occupy his or her mind with fictional or worldly trivia, silly fantasy, daydreaming, or imagination. That's a commentation by Hari Harinanda. It's quite inspiring. I mean, I think if we read through this text and actually see the benefits of yoga, the benefits of really the internal benefits, it's not just... It's mystical on one level because we're generally not aware of the metaphysics, the subtle metaphysics of the universe that's revealed in yoga, but your whole internal self is reorganized by following the rules and regulations. And ultimately it leads to a higher state of happiness. I just took a note and just wanted to see, this is a quote from Ayurveda that I don't know if we'll get up to it, but I was studying it today. Whatever is good or most desired in this life or the next is attained by intense concentration of the mind. So you can't even begin to control the mind if you're not careful how you deal with others. Okay, and the next thing is celibacy. There's no crazy machine outside. What is that? Anyway. quote, now celibacy. It's interesting. A teacher has to be celibate. Of course, in yoga, it's not even a question of marriage, actually. But at least the there has to be control of the sex life. And a teacher has to be celibate because the benefit of celibacy is that one's words will be infallible. So if one is not celibate, then it doesn't matter how scholarly he is, his words won't be convincing. They'll lack potency or shakti. And you can actually see this, but sometimes you hear a scholar and it just doesn't, you hear an honest man, even the words may be more simple, they're more penetrating. We all have that experience. Anyway, this is classic from the Daksha Samhita. Yajnavalkya also quotes it. We had that, that from the Bhagavatam. The eight kinds of sexual indulgences are thinking, talking, and joking about sex, looking at the opposite sex with passion, talking secretly about sex, determining to engage in it, attempting to do so, and actually performing the act. And therefore, for the yogi, and this is again Hariharananda, says that a frugal diet and moderate sleep are important to celibacy. Plenty of milk and butter may be sattvic for an ordinary person, he says, but not for a yogi. In short, all realization cannot be attained if one is sexually active, because this indicates that one is still seeking fulfillment on the sensual level, and that's misidentifying with the non-self. Why does a yogi try to get rid of thoughts? Because the whole purpose of self-realization is to free the self from the identification with the body. And the identification with the body is due to the thoughts that are there. When the thoughts are quelled, the self has no choice but to turn to itself. Of course, in the path of bhakti, this is what I was trying to mention, that we try to gear the thoughts and the nature of the mind to the nature of the self, which in the conception of bhakti is a servant of God. So it's a very interesting process because you try to invoke thoughts of God, and then when you develop bhakti or bhava, the thoughts are no longer controlled by material samskaras, but they're ruled by your devotion. And as devotion is the nature of the soul, the thoughts become congruent with the soul. This is the difference. Then renunciation of possessions. Very nice definition by Vyas. The ability to see problems caused by the acquisition, preservation, and destruction of things, since these only provoke attachment and injury. So, it's explained, the commentators, Hariharananda again. If you have the book, I suggest that you could read this purport. It's very simple and clear, very important. For such reasons, possessions produce some scars, and these activate the... Oh, it says there's trouble acquiring things in the first place. Now, remember, this is an aesthetic. This is not the what the Karma Yoga mentioned in Bhagavad Gita for a person in the world. But obviously, it, although there's not complete vairagya, obviously the same principles hold. There's trouble acquiring things, trouble in trying to preserve them, and trouble and distress when we lose them. So possessions therefore produce some scars. Attachments, very, very strong attachments in their acquisition, in their preservation, and in their destruction. And as we know, the samskaras produce karma. because we have to act on them, and therefore we become entangled in samsara. And the distress is there, because what is distress? It's hankering, and it's lamenting, I want this, I lost this. It's going to be very, and when we discuss the niyams, it's going to be a very beautiful discussion that one quality of the yogi is just satisfied. Whatever he has, it's enough. Whatever he has, it's God's grace. It's a challenge. I'm a sannyasi. That's the way I'm supposed to live. But I can see it's a challenge for me. I try to live detached. I try to be that way. At least I know in Vrindavan, I didn't have any place to stay for many, many years. And then I thought, oh, let me somehow see if I can get money and buy a place. And I did say no. I should be satisfied with what God gives me. Eventually he did give me a place, and I'm satisfied with that. But here's very hoarding wealth without sharing it is sheer selfishness and points to complete lack of sympathy for the plight of others. This is very, very heavy. Hoarding wealth without sharing it is sheer selfishness. So yogis don't hoard wealth. They immediately spend it for the benefit of others. Also says the Brahmin is like that. Whatever he gets in the morning is spent in the evening. So this is, again, a very high standard. I don't know how many of you know Professor Bryant, who I'm reading his commentary, but I see from teaching the Yoga Sutras for many, many years, he really, really tries to live by these yams and niyams. I mean, he's got a very good professorship that pays well. He also is a lecturer every week. He travels even around the world. And he never asks for money, but he generally gets a couple thousand dollars or something. You know, he doesn't. But if you know him, he just gives in charity. He spends the money. He doesn't have this. He tries to practice this. I know that. Therefore, yogis attempt to give up all objects of enjoyment and take only what is required for their maintenance. No enjoyment can be gained without some level of direct or indirect injury to others, says Chakravarti Mishra. Reaffirming Vyasa's comments about the centrality of ahimsa among the yamas. So again, then this progression is mentioned again, because the yamas produce their effects without any other factors. If you're nonviolent, you're going to get the result of an aura and vibration that will quell aggression around you. If you are celibate, your words will be convincing. But the niyams, they're dependent on the yamas. You can't perform them unless you perform the yamas. So again, it's now we'll go to, then he says, this is, these yamas are considered the great vow. They are exempted, not exempted by one's class, place, time, or circumstance. They are universal. So I'm going to read this very important sutra. Chajali state that the yamas are absolute and universal for aspiring yogis. They cannot be transgressed or exempted under any circumstance, such as class, jati, place, desha, time, kala, or circumstances, samya. They are non-negotiable for yogis. Patanjali is being conspicuously and uncharacteristically emphatic here. Not only the yamas, a vrata vow, but a mahavrata, great vow. This great vow is further qualified as sarvabhoma. It's universal. And then he elaborates so that he eliminates any grounds to anybody making an exception. And Professor Bryant, who's conversant with, you know, Indian spiritual history, conjectures that just there's always people looking for excuses. And unless you, if you, something is important, unless you make it emphatic and eliminate the exceptions that people can make, people will find exceptions to them. So if something's very, very important, it's, you know, one time someone said to Prabhupada, what if I can't follow the regular principles? And Prabhupada said, then I can't help you, or something like that. You know, I'm not sure about that quote. I seem to remember it, but the gist of it is that you have to be very emphatic, and he is. And therefore, he says there, anavichinana, they're not exempted because of class. Jati, place, station, time. There's an absolute statement that can be made. Professor Bryant makes a contemporary perception that in the yoga community in America, there's a lot of discussion about the jurisdiction of the yamas in the 21st century. And he said, whatever the discussions take place, whether they're not to, and whatever hybrid practices evolve, this sutra makes it clear that as far as Patanjali is concerned, there are no exceptions to these yamas, these rules, for anyone. And he said that one may imagine that in Patanjali's own circle, there would have been followers or disciples angling for exceptions to one or another of the yamas. For example, someone who's not in the Brahmin caste, the Kshatriya caste eat meat, or they have engaged in sexuality, they come to yoga, they're saying maybe there's an exception because of the Shastra and rules according to my social studies. No, if you want to come to yoga, it's an ascetic tradition. Especially these, there's no negotiation in terms of ahimsa, truthfulness, refrainment from stealing, coveting of his possessions, celibacy, and a simple life. And the purport's just so clear. I'm just really looking at the purport, but he goes that in all the spiritual traditions in India, and even in the more worldly Dharma Sutra, in other words, more worldly means where you're concerned with Vanashram and Pravritti Marg, the path of attachment, where you keep your things and purify them, or the ascetic tradition, the Vritti Marg. These yamas are universal. And even in non-Vedic, like Buddhism, outside the Vedas, same thing. They have the Eightfold Noble Path, which require five shilas form, which are nonviolence, truthfulness, celibacy, etc. Identical to the yamas. Jains have vows, nyaya shutras, which discuss acknowledgement yoga, entails following these things, and the Gita. So, these are the principles. And the commentators, because of the centrality of ahimsa, now they go and show how ahimsa is universal and not exempted by one's class, place, time, or circumstance. For example, by class, a fisherman, right? He eats fish and inflicts violence only on fish but nowhere else. The Kshatriyas are allowed to engage in violence in certain contexts, hunting, for example, the battlefield. While there may be some social exemption from ahimsa, in yoga, it doesn't matter what your jati or birth is, even if you're born into a caste that eats meat, Kshatriya who has legitimate violence, you're not exempted from ahimsa. And we know from Bhagavad Gita that happy are those Kshatriyas whose battles come unsought, they're guaranteed the heavenly planets. But in the ascetic tradition, doesn't matter what your caste or is, you're not exempt. So what is required in a social context, the Kshatriya may fight, is renounced in an ascetic context for the yogi. An example of nonviolence by place is a person who abstains from violence in a sacred place but kills animals elsewhere, or so violence must be upheld regardless of this situation, the desha, the country, the culture, the time. Sometimes nonviolence is conditioned by time, as one abstains from a certain thing on a calendar occasion, I guess during a religious observance, abstaining from meat at Lent, the Catholic context, but not at other times. Yogis must be nonviolent at all times. It's unconditioned by the circumstance. Vedic rituals that require sacrifice. If you're a yogi, you can't participate in those. Even in Ayurveda, certain diseases may require some type of, it's rare, but a cure may contain some animal product, dead animal, etc., but no exceptions. The yogis practice at all times, all conditions, everywhere, irrespective of any condition. So his intent is very, very clear on this, that these yamas, not just nonviolent. Very interesting point. Professor Bryant deals with the accusation sometimes that because yoga cannot be considered strictly a moral system, since its goals are not altruistic, but it's focused on the liberation of the individual self, thus it's self-centered and egotistic. And the response is that even though the goal of yoga is individualistic, cannot be obtained except through moral means of interaction with others, as indicated in the five yamas. So, Okay, let me go on one more verse, and then we can have a discussion. Thank Krishna that electricity is on, and we're moving forward. It was so disappointed yesterday that we got cut off. Now we go. So we did the yamas, now the niyamas. The observances are cleanliness, contentment, austerity, study of the scriptures and devotion to God. Socha, santosha, tata, svaya, yeshvara, pranidana, ni, niyamaha. In contrast with the yamas, which are concerned with how the yogis interacts with others, the niyamas are centered on one's personal discipline and practice. So again, this is the difference. Okay. So first, cleanliness, socha, it's external and internal cleanliness. External cleanliness is the environment. Brahman means always cleaning. The environment is kept very clean and in the mode of goodness. You know, everything was clean in India with water, clay, cow dung, pure substances, and also what you ingest. Indeed, intoxication causes the mind to be agitated and stimulated. They excite rajas and tamas, so yogi never imbibes such substances. And the internal cleanliness is purifying the mind of contamination. Very interesting. Contamination, commentators speak of pride, jealousy, vanity, hatred, attachment. This is mental contamination. Bhojaraj states that internal cleanliness is accomplished by benevolence, exuding a friendly attitude towards all. Again, how ahimsa becomes santosh, contentment, means disinterested in accumulating more than one's immediate needs of life. So this is a little bit different. This is contentment. Before it discussed asetya, non-stealing, don't covet another's possessions. And here it says, even if you legitimately acquire something, don't accumulate more than your needs. Of course, it will increase your desires, and lust is never satisfied, and your consciousness will be externalized. True happiness comes from contentment, whatever one has, not with thinking that one will be happy when one gets all that one desires. Very, very powerful. True happiness comes from contentment with whatever one has, not with thinking that one will be happy when one gets all that one desires. Even if there's some lack, says Shankar, one thinks it is enough. As Harinanda puts it, to avoid injury from thorns, one only has to wear one pair of shoes. One doesn't need to cover the entire earth with leather. So whatever you get, it's enough. These are real challenges for us, especially in the modern world where the whole economy is based on increasing your needs above your needs. It's to create artificial needs. I remember from way back studying Eric Fromm, who said real freedom is freedom from want. So many needs are created. I mean, we have to be very careful. Computers, then we need an upgrade, and an upgrade, and an upgrade, and an upgrade, and an iPod, and an upgrade, and it goes on, and that you this, and clothes, and this. Can't be yogis.
advertising destroys yoga. They know yoga, and they know how to create samskaras in the mind and increase your needs and your burning. We're all burning. If we need more and this and that, glasses and this kind of glasses and fancy and this and more and more and more. That's the whole economy is based on agitating the mind. It's so nice. I mean, when I take those walks now and then I visit my friends, Frankie Shore and Gitavari and Ati Sundari at their farm, and they just live right off their land. Everything grows on a small plot in their land. They buy rice once a year, whatever they have is enough. I know there are challenges in the modern context. That's why Prabhupada wanted to change the modern context. Next nema, austerity, toughest, is the ability to tolerate hunger and thirst, as well as all the dualities of life, hot and cold, to avoid useless talks and to perform fasts. Yoga requires tolerant suffering of the body because that detaches one from the body. When the body gives difficulty in the execution of spiritual life, then one gains the ability and desire to extract oneself from the body. That's the psychological phenomena of attachment and austerity. Attachment increases the desire to identify with the body and therefore increases suffering. And austerity decreases the desire to identify with the body and therefore increases happiness. Dupo divyam yena kaput sattvam shudyet sokyam brahma sokyam puranta. Tolerate, remain undisturbed. But this is not self-imposed. This is just what comes to you. It's not that you voluntarily have to, carry a cross on your back or something. But what comes, just in our normal life, we just tolerate. And it's very important for yogi. I mean, Vrindavan used to be meant for that. Now, I haven't used it yet, but I'm looking at this automatic big air conditioner that was just installed. Heater, which we never had before. When I first came to Vrindavan, we had to tolerate. Now, any discomfort? Fortunate for me, electricity goes off, so I do get a nice chance to tolerate. And then because I now have these modern amenities, I suffer more when that happens. Study Swadhyaya refers to sacred scriptures whose subject matter is liberation. The commentators also include the repetition of Om here. Expands this to include Harinamana, the devotional mantras. He notes that by practicing this niyam, one's desires for worldly objects diminish and one's taste for spiritual objects increase. That's the thing of Swadhyaya study. And finally, Ishvara Pranidhan, which was already discussed as the optional but recommended object of meditation. It was also discussed as one of the three aspects of Kriya Yoga. Now it's being discussed as one of the obligatory moral observances. And Gita also recommends that. So this is Ishvara Pranidhan, worshipping of God. And Yas says, let's see. Vyas quotes that while lying down, sitting, or wandering on the road, one who is focused within and whose doubts are weakened sees the seeds of samsara's weakening. Such a person, always firm in yoga, becomes eternally free and partakes in immortality. He adds that it is from devotion to Ishvara that this takes place. Obstacles are removed, and one is able to realize the innermost consciousness. So, this last paragraph is very, very telling. Listen carefully. Chaspati Mistra considers devotion to Ishvara to be the most important of all the yamas and niyams. As we will see below, cultivating the yams and niyams produces beneficial results, but it is only from Ishvara Pranidhan that the ultimate result of yoga, namely samadhi, is seen. That's going to be coming up, because they're going to discuss all the benefits of the niyams, the moral observances, and you get some kind of material benefit, but the benefit of this following and worshiping God, which means to meditate on God and God's names and offer one's activities to God, the benefit of this is samadhi, which is the goal of yoga. So, it is important to note here that although Ishvara Pranidhan was optional as an object of meditation in the first chapter, it is not optional here in the context of niyam. As with the requirements of Kriya Yoga at the beginning of this chapter, Pantanjali is requiring a theistic practice, at least at this point in his system. So if you want to be a yogi, you have to have a theistic process, because the ultimate perfection of anything requires some mercy from a higher power. It's kind of like, let's say you lose a key in New York City during a parade. It doesn't matter how sharp, how intelligent, how good your eyesights are. Unless you're directed to a particular place where that key was dropped, whatever abilities you have will not bear fruition. So it's like that with yoga and spiritual realization and yin. There's a limit to what the intelligence does and how it can bring us. So there has to be some kind of mercy that comes in the full, from higher power in terms of realization to proceed and to perfect yourself in any process that you adopt. Even a great musician, a real great scientist, most of it, they're very intelligent, but they get the answer by revelation. Aha! There's some inner direction. So that inner direct. So this exchange with the Absolute in the form of his name, the Dhammi Buddha Yogam Tvam, by the knowledge is given by which one can perceive. And it's like that on any path. Okay, because my car will go, we'll take breakfast, a few things. We have a few minutes. Anybody like to ask any questions? Anybody like to say hello?
I just want to ask this, Govardhan.
Govardhan, I'm so grateful that you're such a steady listener. I mean, I'm really looking forward to seeing you and your family when I get back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to say hello? Either it's pre-New Year's Eve, and there's a party, or people are shy. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Gopa Kishore.
Gopa, thank you. Thank you so much for... Hey, the 6, right? We have that program?
Is that what we decided? March 6th?
Wasn't it?
I wasn't... I'm not sure, but, is that a Saturday?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine then.
I look at our correspondence. I believe it was the 6th, you know?
Okay. I'll double check.
And, let me know if it's it could be if
okay.
It is, word should get out, okay? Just look at
okay.
What we discussed. Okay?
All right. Okay. Thanks for class. Kishore just bought me the book for Christmas. It was one of my Christmas presents, so I got a lot out of today's class following along in the book.
But you're following the book along with the class.
Yeah. I mean, this was the first time because I just got the book, but it helped me a lot following in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. This purport was particularly clear, and it's very inspiring. You know.
Mhm.
It's really, really inspiring. Self-development. You know, becoming yogis within our context of where we're situated socially. It's really inspiring. I mean. You got to hear what's human life's about, so that's great. Well, anyway, Gop, thank you for coming on today. That's great.
Okay, thank you. Check
that out, see what we agreed, and then let's go forward with it. Unless there's some obstacle that comes, then you could speak to me. All right, Neil.
Okay, great. Yep. Hare Krishna.
All right. Any else like that, hello? Okay. That's okay. We can go now. Once you call for the Sindhu, baby, the child.